Gresham College presents Tudor Health Reform, an introduction by Professor Tim Connell, Honorary Fellow of Gresham College.
Well, good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to the Gresham Symposium today on the subject of Tudor Health Reform. I'm Professor Tim Connell. I'm one of the fellows at the college. And we're going to have a wonderful afternoon because I've brought the wrong glasses. So most of this is going to be from memory. We have an interesting lineup today, including one or two Gresham regulars. Very pleased to welcome back Dr. Alan Chapman from Oxford, a visiting professor here at the college, and our current professor of physics, Will Ayliffe, will be with us as soon as he's finished sewing up his present patient. And we have Carol Rawcliffe here from the University of East Anglia, who's currently on a Wellcome Foundation grant working on the medieval urban health. So she's sitting there ready to correct me with most of the things I'll be saying this afternoon. One incontrovertible thing which we have to say at the beginning of a Gresham event, the famous words of Sir Thomas Gresham, which are, "Would you please switch off your mobile phones?" So this is an interesting subject, particularly because we have to bear in mind that in the Tudor period, there's a major upheaval, which of course is the dissolution of the monasteries. And this has a great deal to do with health, because hospitals, as we see today with so many hospitals having saints' names, have a connection to the church, the monasteries are dissolved, and reorganisation is necessary. And I believe that Will Ayliffe will be talking about that in some detail. Tudor health is a popular subject these days. You'll find it at Key Stage 2 if your grandchildren are at primary level. It's also an option at GCSE. And if you saw the recent Dan Snow series on Dirty Cities, there is a view that it was a picture of dirt, disease and death bound down by superstition, quack remedies and bizarre medicines. Now, there may be an element of truth in that, but I hope today, looking at this in more detail, we're going to talk about the more positive points and rather more good news stories than might meet the eye. Now, I feel slightly hesitant having sort of world-level experts in the front row. Can I add to my misery by asking, do we have any doctors in the audience today? All right. Do we have any nurses? Any midwives? Any members of St. John's Ambulance Brigade? Okay, well, I'm all right because I got my first aid badge at the Scouts. Okay, then. If we focus on the human condition at any time in history, a key experience for all concerned was childbirth and infancy. The population of the British Isles grows in this period, and nowhere more so than in London, where between the birth of Henry VIII in 1509, death of Elizabeth in 1603, London grows from a population of 90,000 to a quarter of a million, which is a fairly massive process of urbanisation. Now, inheritance and succession are of critical importance, from titles and great estates down to quite ordinary trades. And there are few greater examples of this than the redoubtable Elizabeth Pickering Jackson Redmond Cholmondeley, who married in the 1530s and 40s. She married no fewer than three members of the Stationers' Company, thereby becoming, not at the same time, Alan, she therefore became the first known professional woman printer in English history. Very successful indeed. Now, families were large, though mortality rates were high, even amongst the great families. And I'm going to concentrate on the upper end, because then we can only imagine what happened at the lower end. Now, for example, no fewer than three queens died giving birth to future kings: Henry V, Henry VIII, Edward VI. On the left, we have the Andrews tomb. I think it's in Northamptonshire. And you can see all the little figures as elements of filial piety in the family tomb. The right-hand side, that's Henry VII. And we'll be hearing about him in a moment. The service for the churching of women in the Book of Common Prayer refers to the great pain and peril of childbirth, which is reflected in the high death rates to be seen in the lying-in hospitals of the next century and beyond. Even 150 years later, in Tristram Shandy, which has to be my favourite book, most of it revolves around the author's birth. By page 789, he still hasn't been born. His father, Mr. Walter Shandy, is prone to philosophising, whereas my uncle Toby, who's surely one of the kindest figures in English literature, takes a rather more practical view. "Of all the riddles of married life," said my father, crossing the landing in order to set his back against the wall, while he propounded it to my uncle Toby, "Of all the puzzling riddles," said he, "in a marriage state, of which you may trust me, brother Toby, there are more asses loathed than all Job's stock of asses could have carried. There is no one that has more intricacies in it than this, that from the very moment the mistress of the house is brought to bed, every female in it, from my lady's gentlewoman down to the cinder wench, becomes an inch taller for it, and give themselves more airs upon that single inch than all their other inches put together." "I think rather," replied my Uncle Toby, "that 'tis we who sink an inch lower. If I meet but a woman with child, I do it. 'Tis a heavy tax upon that half of our fellow creatures, brother Shandy," said my Uncle Toby. "'Tis a piteous burden upon him," continued he, shaking his head. "Yes, yes, 'tis a painful thing," said my father, shaking his head too. "But certainly, since shaking of heads came into fashion, never did two heads shake together in concert from two such different springs." Now, in real life, Parson Woodford's remarkable diary of 18th century life in Norfolk recounts in some detail the case of the squire's lady, Mrs. Custance. Now, she had 11 children, poor thing, in 12 years, and was left virtually crippled in the last confinement. But three of the children died in infancy, and here's the interesting thing from the 1780s. Three lived to be over 80 years of age, two lived to be over 90, living to the 1860s, which gives us some insight into the increase in longevity brought about by improved health conditions in the 19th century, but not, of course, among children. Now, the death rate among women of childbearing age seems to have been near epidemic levels, which must have led to other issues such as the care of surviving children, disruption to the home economy, and indeed, whole families. Now, I find it hard to believe that people face such levels of human tragedy with nothing more than fatal resignation, and pious though people undoubtedly were, the comfort of religion must have been fairly bleak in the face of it. The burial service, 1662, reminds us that in the midst of life, we are in death. And people in Tudor times must have been acutely aware of that. If we take the example, as I mentioned, of Henry VII, he lost his son and heir, Prince Arthur, died April 1502. His wife died in childbirth less than a year later in February 1503, and the baby didn't survive either. Now, apart from any personal feelings, there were dynastic issues to take into account, although Henry, in the end, decided not to marry Catherine of Aragon, as he might have done, and he died without having any further issue. But now, if this was the experience of the monarch, how must his subjects have fared from the lady's gentlewoman down to the cinder wench? At the other end of the Tudor-Stuart spectrum, almost 100 years later, there's the sad example of poor Queen Anne. She went through 18 pregnancies, of which 13 were miscarriages or stillbirths. Four children died before the age of two, and one died suddenly and unexpectedly after a two-day illness at the age of 11. And again, major dynastic implications, with the crown passing subsequently to the German Georges and the Hanoverians. George I didn't speak English, George II didn't like speaking English, and George III was off his trolley. But what we can't discount is the suffering of the poor queen, and of course, the unfortunate Prince George of Denmark, who was her consort. Now, with regard to disease specifically in Tudor times, I mustn't get too far off the subject, Alan, there was no lack of choice when it came to things to die of, ranging from dysentery and typhoid to malaria, smallpox and leprosy. And that was just the fate of the kings of England. There were all sorts of epidemics, not least of which was a sweating sickness, which has never been precisely identified, but which had a devastating effect on the population. It was what killed Prince Arthur, heir to Henry VII, and nearly killed his young wife, Catherine of Aragon. And had she not been around, the 16th century would have looked very different. Now, to quote the bard in Richard II, "Let us sit upon the ground and tell sad stories of the death of kings, how some have been deposed, some slain in war, some haunted by the ghosts they have deposed, some poisoned by their wives, some sleeping killed, all murdered. For within the hollow crown that rounds the mortal temples of a king keeps death his court." Wonderful last line there. To put it more prosaically, two English monarchs died of dysentery, Edward I and Henry V, two of TB, Edward VI and possibly James I. Henry IV Part I may have had leprosy, though some people think that Henry IV Part II only had psoriasis and died of something else. Edward III had a stroke, Mary died of ovarian cancer, and only Henry VII and Elizabeth appear to have died of complications of old age. Curiously enough, relatively few princes, and this is very important, succeed their father to the throne. The Black Prince may have had multiple sclerosis. Henry VIII's illegitimate son, very popular figure, Henry Fitzroy, had TB, and Prince Henry, the highly promising son of James I, as intelligent as his father was stupid, died of typhoid at the age of 19. So the course of history would have been different had any of these survived to take the crown. Now, we have to mention leprosy. Gresham audience always gets excited about squelchy diseases. It was a sufficient threat for dedicated hospitals to be set up. This is Harbledown, just outside Canterbury. I used to go past it every day on the way to school, which is why I put it up there. In the 16th century, I would have gone to school by a different route, because the inmates of the hospital used to come out to meet the pilgrims to ask them to kiss a relic of Thomas a Becket, or to kiss one of them. And of course, everybody went in a different way. And Erasmus himself commented on how unpleasant a welcome to Canterbury this was. Things have improved a bit since then. Then, of course, there was the plague, which hit London in 1563, 1593, 1597, and 1603, killing tens of thousands of people in the process. It affected all levels of society. Shakespeare actually loses three sisters and a brother to the disease. And it caused a great deal of upheaval as people left London for lengthy periods of time if they could, and if in fact they were allowed to. For ordinary people and lesser afflictions, there were the folk remedies. The wise woman with her knowledge of herbs, and housewives would have had their own remedies for family ailments, some of which, to quote Nicholas Culpepper, might indeed have helped mightily against the emerods. Many houses would have had a physic garden, let's have a cheerful picture, of the sort that the Barber Surgeons Company has today, the hall just near here, with all the medicinal herbs of the period. If you go onto their website, which is on the transcript, they also list what the herbs were and what they were used for. So that's rather nice. Now, of course, travel in those days could be dangerous. Sir Thomas Gresham broke a leg falling off his horse and limped for the rest of his life. And his only son, we come back to inheritance, his only son, a promising youth aged 20, died from falling off a horse, as, of course, did William III 60 years later. Industrial accidents, not to mention occupational hazards, must have been common, with risks ranging from tetanus to septicemia. There was only the vaguest notion of hygiene and public health, even though, I'm saying it before you say it, the city authorities did take the matter seriously, far more so than Dan Snow would have us believe. Now, a great deal of human suffering lies behind all of this, and I'm something of a renegade in this matter. Did people really tolerate, with apparent helplessness, this situation in the run-up to the Age of Reason? When Prince Octavius dies at the age of 4, 1783, King George III is so affected, he cries, "There will be no heaven for me if Octavius is not there." And poor old Queen Charlotte produced 15 children, five of whom died in infancy, and Octavius, in fact, was the third. So we might say that George should have got used to the idea by then, but he was particularly fond of Octavius, and the family was greatly affected. Then, of course, if you go back to the Old Testament, we have the great lament of King David, "Would God I had died for thee, O Absalom, my son, my son." And Absalom was not exactly the perfect son, since he raped his half-sister and led a rebellion against his dad. And King David was still sorry to see him go. Now, I don't believe that the elderly wealthy would have been prepared to accept infirmity. And I'm cynical enough to say that the medical profession wouldn't have wanted them to either, let alone the quacks and the mountebanks, of which there were many at the time. There's ample evidence of bequests, legacies, and endowments for hospitals or the relief of suffering to show that people have cared as much then as we do today with our donations to heart or cancer charities. This is the Earl of Northampton, who left money to the Mercers Company in 1614 for what was called Trinity Hospital, not a hospital for sick patients, more of an almshouse or old people's home. The Robert Kitchen bequest goes back, I think, to 1561, still managed by the Mercers today. So I would prefer to think that there are two key human characteristics in all of this, which come to the fore in the face of constant ongoing pain and personal tragedy. One is human compassion. You don't just stand by and let it happen. The medical people amongst you might know the dreadful phrase, "Is there nothing else that can be done, doctor?" which in the modern world comes far later than would have been the case 400 years ago. And the other aspect in all of this is human ingenuity. I tend to listen with disbelief to some of the latest inventions which are appearing in the medical world, but I listen to them with some relief because they might be working properly by the time I need one of them. Now, I have in the past put my foot in it at a Gresham symposium by using all the examples that the following speakers were going to use. So I've asked their permission to talk about medicine at sea, which by and large they're not going to touch on too much. Now, important because we've got ships' logs, memoirs, reports, and the needs of a growing navy to provide us with quite a lot of data, which is actually being put online. You can read the surgeon's reports from the 17th century, if you get really excited about this, in the comfort of your own home. And, of course, the impact of printing, which will be the subject of another Gresham lecture sometime, I hope, and the growth of manuals and textbooks. And, of course, things that people can use. On the left-hand side, we have the surgeon's chest for the Mary Rose. He wasn't expecting the ship to sink that afternoon. That chest is the way it was. We also have sackfuls of bones belonging to his patients, so we've got a fairly good idea as to what state of health they were into. On the right, we have the Giustiniani chest. Belongs to the Wellcome, but it's actually in the Science Museum, if you want to pop along and have a look at it. There are 126 bottles and containers of different potions, some of which are still full, so we've got a fairly good idea as to what a 16th century doctor in Genoa might have actually had at his disposal. And it can't all be hocus-pocus. Some of that stuff must work for its particular purpose. Now, as England's maritime power expanded, navigational skills grew, exploration starts across the globe. Sir Hugh Willoughby, North Cape and beyond in the 1550s. Sir Martin Frobisher looking for the Northwest Passage in the 1570s. And Drake, of course, goes around the world 1577 to 1580. Now, the problem was not the ships, they were fairly sturdy, not the navigational instruments, though, of course, longitude is a couple of hundred years off, but scurvy, which is a killer. Now, if you really want a nice, gruesome experience, go into Google, put in scurvy, and hit images. Or you may prefer not to. I preferred the image on the right-hand side. This is Mervyn Peake's centenary year. And I'm advertising, of course, the Gresham Lecture on the 5th of October. This was an image from The Ancient Mariner. And when it was drawn in 1947, it was rejected by the publisher for being too gruesome. And it didn't appear in print till 1973. Isn't that curious? It's a figure of death in life. What I really wanted was the picture of the scurvy knaves and the crew, but that's not free on Google, so you're not getting it. You have to get the book yourself. But scurvy. Early voyage to the Spice Islands in 1610, major economic venture. Four ships out of five, so stricken with scurvy, they can't get beyond St. Helena. And the only exception, crew number five, were the ones who'd been issued with lemon juice. Now, a perfect Baconian experience, five ships, four go down, one is fit as a fiddle, and they were still looking for remedies, one of which was thought to be mustard. And, of course, it's quite a long time before lime juice comes into the Royal Navy. So, but it would have been a great Baconian experiment. Both sides in the Spanish Armada, seriously debilitated by disease. We like to talk the Spanish side down, but they had a formidable navy. The Duke of Medina Sidonia got it quite right. Part of the reason for the failure of the expedition, poor and unhygienic conditions on board ship, and the poor quality of the rations being served. True on both sides. Lord Howard of Effingham to the Council, 1st of September 1588. English ships in harbour. The crew are so weak they cannot raise anchor. And he was hoping to God the Spanish didn't come back down the channel because we could not have stopped them. If, as the Duke of Parma wanted, the Navy had reformed in the North Sea and come up the Thames estuary, nobody could have stopped them. So it's an interesting thought about what an early cure for scurvy might actually have done for both sides. Oddly enough, we see, I've mentioned publishing, this is John Bannister, Anatomical Tables, one of the first English publications. You can see all the, this is not a butcher's shop, this is actually a surgery. You can see all the wonderful instruments, I love the hammer. Down, Frank Cox can tell you all how to use these, he's got a set at home. And in fact, there's a piglet being dissected on the table. If that's what they could do to pigs, think what they could do to sailors. And of course, John Bannister had been chief surgeon of the voyage to the East Indies, 1582, and the first medical textbook specifically on surgery at sea, William Clowes, 1588. So the growing strength of the Navy, the growing importance of the Navy, the growing significance of investment overseas has a side effect, which is the improvement of medicine, because sailors are expensive and scarce, trained sailors. The press gang is all right for your lower deck men, but not if you want people who know how to sail a ship. So, medicine in print, Ambroise Paré, who I should now refer to as Ambrose because I can't say Ambroise, the great French physician. I thought I'd talk about France because I was pretty sure Ireland wouldn't, you see. Born in 1510, died in 1590, pretty good advert for a doctor, lived to be 80, and he was royal physician to no fewer than four kings of France, which of course means that three of them died under his care, but I won't say that out loud. Like so many other doctors in the period, he gained his experience as a battlefield surgeon. The lads were going to die anyway, so he might as well have a practice on them. What did Paré do? He realised that cauterisation, hot steel on an amputated limb, did not do the patient very much good. And he came up with a fairly obvious thing, which is tying off the arteries with ligatures, which, oddly enough, the Romans had known about and people had forgotten about in the intervening period. And he also invented a thing called the crow's beak, which any modern-day surgeon would recognise as a hemostat, which is a device which is used to make sure that you can increasingly clamp something without having to let go of it in order to tie things up nice and neatly. And he was an interesting man. He wrote a huge number of books, sadly enough, not translated into English for a very long time afterwards, because one of the other many things, odd for a battlefield surgeon, he was also an expert in obstetrics, and he came up with a workable solution to what is called podal version, whereby the fetus presents in a transversal position, and of course it can't come out in that direction. You've got to do something about it to save the mother. And he worked out a technique, which again was eventually used for a very long time. The other example I'm fond of, because I had to do a special paper on him at university, is François Rabelais, famous for dirty jokes, famous for Gargantua and Pantagruel, less known as a doctor of theology and a doctor of medicine. He took his doctorate in 1532, and he became an expert in syphilis, which at the time was thought to be a version of leprosy, and he actually lectured on the subject and writes about it, of course, satirically in all of his books. He lectured on surgery, and he actually invented a device to prevent foreshortening of a broken limb. So the 16th century, to round up, is a time of change. The great medieval masters, Galen and Hippocrates, still hold sway, and people still believe in the four humours and astrology, and Tudor doctors would actually have recognised, not necessarily believed anymore, but recognised the list of medical textbooks which you find in the Canterbury Tales being read by the Doctor of Physic. Medical knowledge is expanding as part of the Renaissance, and more recognisably scientific approaches are becoming evident. Key figures emerge, like Thomas Lineker, who brings back the new learning from Italy. As so often, this is coming back in from abroad, it's not homegrown, but he is pivotal in the foundation of the original College of Physicians, established by a royal charter of 1518 from Henry VIII. The more traditional barber surgeons, we have to mention the livery companies in the city, they go back to at least 1308, they're founded certainly before that. They receive their first charter, 1462, from Edward IV. The barbers were confined to their traditional roles of bloodletting and tooth drawing. Besides cutting your hair, they were allowed to pull teeth out. In 1540, the Worshipful Company of Barbers and Surgeons of London, founded by Act of Parliament. So there's evidence here of attempting to define the roles of different types of practitioner, and perhaps to take a more modern approach to the subject. So today, how hospitals are reformed and how medicine changes in the Tudor period is something that we shall hear about in more detail today. I am pleased and relieved to pass the microphone over to Professor Carol Rawcliffe of the University of East Anglia, and she's going to tell us about the form and function of medieval hospitals, because we can't just take a period and cut it at the beginning and cut it at the end. Real life ain't like that. And I think we may find out some interesting things about the medieval period, which will come as a surprise to you if you've done Key Stage 2 or GCSE on the history of medicine. Carol.
For all information, please go to our website at www.gresham.ac.uk.